All right, welcome to another WaitingForNextYear.com podcast. This is Craig Lindell, and I've got Andrew on the line, and I'm actually on location in Boston.
So. Yeah, you're in the spot that I think all of the writers wish we were.
Yeah, you have a lot of jealous coworkers here.
Yeah, it's funny. You know, this is my Star Trek convention. This is I don't dress up like a Star Wars character. I pretend to be a good enough sports writer to justify coming to events once a year. Apparently,
hey, you dress up like a sports writer.
It's a lot of button down shirts with sweaters over top. That's what I'm wearing right now. So,
absolutely.
I think it's the uniform. I've heard there are a lot of people treat this like a. Like a job interview and networking event, and so there'll be a lot of suits and coats and ties tomorrow.
Huh.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just interesting.
I don't even know what to expect.
Yeah, I was going to ask you kind of about that. I don't know if this is a podcast discussion or something we should have discussed offline before we started, but I was just kind of curious. So, like, when you go there, you're not going as one of the media members who are there to, I guess what they would say, quote unquote, cover it. You're actually a participant in it, correct?
I mean, participant in as much as. Like I'm not covering it. I don't have a specific storyline to come out of it. I would say I'm fulfilling the role of student, even though I'm far too old compared to. There are a lot of young bucks here, man.
Sure. Well, I didn't mean like that. You were on a panel or anything like that, but
yeah.
I think that they actually give like press credentials for people to cover it as the media. Which is kind of a weird thing to have, like it's like media covering media, but
well, the whole thing is sponsored by ESPN among some other organizations, and I'm guessing that they wouldn't credential too many media here because then they wouldn't have anybody in attendance.
Exactly. That's why I said it's a weird thing, but I and maybe I'm totally wrong on this, but I thought for sure I saw that somewhere where somebody had said that they actually give out some kind of media. Credentials or whatever for people to cover it.
I'm sure there are some.
Yeah, you'd think they could find some people there to cover it, though. I mean, you'd think.
Well, and I guess that's really my goal. I mean, I'm not on assignment. This isn't something that Waiting for Next Year kind of like put me up to. This was like everybody talked longingly about this event, and then
I'll bucket list thing.
Yeah, I'll break down a wall. I asked permission from my wife, who's home with two kids. So, and she said it was cool. So I made it happen. And I guess my goal really is to just learn as much as I can, but also probably, you know, I'd like to find at least five things to write about related to Cleveland coming out of this.
Well, for sure. I mean, we're in kind of a slow period right now anyways with, you know, the draft is still, you know, a little bit of ways away for the NFL. Baseball hasn't started yet, and the Cavs are, you know, they're not going into the playoffs. They're playing better basketball, but they're not going to the playoffs right now. So it's kind of a slow time anyway. So if you can go out there and get a couple stories and a couple angles to cover, that's even better. But even if you don't, I think it's still a pretty I got to imagine this is going to be a pretty worthwhile excursion for you. I imagine it's something pretty sweet because, like I said, I mean, I think all of us wish we were there. You're the one who was fortunate enough to, you know, be able to actually go.
Well, no, there's only one Cleveland-related person, I think, here, and that's Alex Shiner. Right. who's a frequent guest of this conference, actually, and he's the one that the Browns hired from the Cowboys he's a president of the Browns. He was a vice president with the Cowboys, and I don't even know exactly what he's doing for the Browns other than he's the president of a great many different things. Could be analytics, could be game day experience, could be a mix of many things, and he's giving a talk tomorrow on true performance and the science of randomness. So, Yeah, he's on a panel with four other guys, and that's the only Cleveland-related thing specifically.
Is there any other Cleveland media members there?
Not that
you know of?
Not listed, but there are some other kind of Cleveland-related bloggers, or super bloggers, if you will, because, you know, they're varying degrees of bloggers, and some of our brethren are actually, you know, paid and have what I would consider real jobs, even though I'd still call them bloggers.
Sure. But I just didn't know so there are other Cleveland bloggers there.
Yeah. I won't name drop them just because, you know, I'm so bad with names and faces. And
yeah.
We've got a couple of guys on our site who are just like walking encyclopedias for different people who write about everything. So like,
yeah.
Scott knows every writer pretty much national and local.
Yeah.
And he just, I don't understand how he remembers them all.
But I'm always impressed both Scott and, Brendan Porath too. Like, both of those guys are just insane with this like innate knowledge of writers and who writes what for who. Like, I'll read something and it'll stick with me, but I guess for me, what I always pick up on is maybe the content of it more so than who wrote it for what. And like, I'll hear a writer's name and I'll say, okay, yeah, I've heard of them, but I don't always know, like, I couldn't tell you exactly who they write for whatever reason. Like, that part of my brain doesn't necessarily stick with me, but I mean, we all have our things. Like, I could tell you, you know, who was the guest guitarist on the sixth track of some obscure album. Like,
right.
And that's something that you know, kind of sticks with me. But yeah, I have the hardest time with, I have a hard time with names anyways. Like, I'm a bad names person, but, when it comes to, you know, remembering who exactly wrote something, like, I just have, and I have a hard time with it sometimes even with our site. Like, I'll be like, man, which of our writers wrote that? Like, I can remember the piece, but I can't always remember exactly who wrote it.
No, even really famous guys too. I mean, I kind of fell in love with Nate Silver's work this year, you know, in the presidential election, and coming from his background where he was. And so I ended up getting his book for Christmas, and I was reading it on, you know, not a real book, obviously. Everything's on a device now. So I'm reading Nate Silver's book, which the name of the book escapes me now. But I was probably halfway through the book, and 6 months into being a fan of his, and I still couldn't remember Nate Silver's name. And so it's like what you're saying. I could remember the blog. I could remember what his work and what he wrote about and why I was impressed by him. But for the life of me, I just could not place Nate Silver's name. It took me about 6 months. I got it now.
Yeah.
But like you, it was the work. I couldn't remember the guy.
Yeah. Like, I don't know what it is. Like, what sort of block I have on that, but I'm bad at that. And like, books is one thing. Like, I'm a little bit better, I think, with, you know, authors who, of books, but yeah, when it comes to like newspaper writing and, magazine writing, like, I'd be hard pressed. If you told me right now to name a Sports Illustrated writer, I'd be hard pressed to give you a name off the top of my head. And I mean, Sports Illustrated is about, you know, the most famous sports magazine. My subscription just ran out, but I've had a subscription for about the last probably 8 years, and I can't tell you a single guy who writes for them. So that tells you how much I pay attention to that.
Yeah, it's like, it's one of those annual Christmas gifts I get from somebody.
Uh-huh.
So mine always gets renewed like clockwork.
Yeah, like, this is the first year. Like I said, I mean, literally, I've had it for probably 8 years, and I don't know why, but, you know, this year, I don't know. I just let it go, I guess.
All right, so let's talk about some Cleveland sports here. I want to talk about Sean Livingston.
Okay.
Is Sean Livingston proof that there is a kind of scouting or a kind of Billy Beane type strategy to personnel in the NBA, or is it just dumb luck?
I think it's a little bit dumb luck. The thing with Livingston is, it's not like he hasn't had opportunities. I mean, he's been around
seven teams,
you know, seven different teams. So it's hard to imagine that you know, he's always been a serviceable player this whole time. And that, you know, somehow nobody figured that out until, you know, the evil genius Chris Grant figured it out. I think it's maybe a sort of one of those things where, you know, we talk about this a lot in sports. Like, so many times a guy gets drafted into like the perfect spot for them, and they, and you just wonder, okay, well, if they didn't get drafted there, how good would they have really been? Like, sort of a RG3 going to Washington, where he has a coach who sort of let him, who sort of designed the offense around his skill set. Now, if the Browns make that trade and the Browns get RG3, and we know Pat Shurmur is awfully rigid in how he wants to run his offense, and he's going to say, no, we need you to run this offense. Well, would he be the same breakout star if that would have happened? I don't necessarily know. And I think that's a little bit maybe what's happened with Sean Livingston, that he just finally had the right opportunity where a team was desperate enough to give him enough playing time to sort of get his legs back, to sort of get back into the feel for the game. Because that's the kind of what I've always wondered, because he's one of the most intriguing players in the NBA. I mean, this guy was on the verge of being a breakout superstar.
Right, but tell me something. So the Cavs claim him off of waivers on Christmas Day from
Washington.
And they basically plug him in the same role that he should have had in Washington, backing up the up and coming, star point guard in John Wall. Does it come down to Byron Scott?
Well, and remember, the thing that's crazy about that too is that John Wall was injured at the beginning of the year too, so that should have been even more time for Livingston. I don't know. You know, obviously, I don't watch a ton of Washington games, so I couldn't tell you exactly what was going on with him in Washington. But I do think Byron Scott deserves a lot of credit because Byron Scott's the one who told Chris Grant, "Let's get this guy." I've read countless reports that have said this was a Byron Scott signing, that he's been intrigued with Sean for a very long time. And when he was available, he basically told Chris Grant, hey, let's go get this guy. He can play for me. So he came in and he plugged him in right away. But even then, I mean, it still took a little bit of time. I don't think Sean Livingston was making much of an impact, in those early games. Now, part of that is getting used to a new team, but I just feel like he's never had a chance to get the feel for the game back. Like, when you're constantly switching teams and moving and going here and there, I just don't think he ever got the consistent game time that you need in order to get that feel for the game back. Especially coming back from such a horrific injury. Have you ever seen the video of it? Of his injury?
A man who's had two ACLs replaced, like I have, does not watch videos like that.
I mean, it's just awful. I mean, it's one of the most crushing videos that's on there. I've only seen it once, and I won't watch it again. I don't have any need to look at that
again.
I
call videos like that videos that I can't unsee.
Yeah, and that's exactly what this is. I mean, I've never seen a knee do what his knee did, and the aftermath of just how displaced his entire knee was. I mean, he basically blew up his knee. Obviously, like that's a lot to come back from, not just physically, but mentally too. Like it was not a contact play. I mean, he just went up for a dunk and he just came down on it wrong.
Let me tell you, as somebody who's come back from two ACLs and not even to attempt to try and play anything to the level of Sean Livingston, when you're coming back from those surgeries, you start walking and you're walking with a certain gait because of the limp and because of the pain, and that develops into a habit, and then you have to break that habit. And it's not like those serious injuries where you have to learn how to walk again, but
sure.
I mean, you are retraining all your muscles to allow you to plant and push off and run and do all those things again. And maybe what you're saying, even after you get all that back and you can run in practice, the speed and the violence of playing live action is different, because you can run down a court and say, all right, well, I'm going to cut in and out four times. That's totally different than playing defense and having and having John Wall make you need to cut, you know, when you when you weren't ready.
There's no simulation for being on a court in a competitive game against the best athletes in the world. Like, no amount of practice or rehab or anything you're doing is going to fully prepare you for that. And I think you just have to go through it. And I can't imagine that first time he went up for a dunk or a layup, like what that feeling is like being in a game and going and doing that exact thing that, you know, the last time you did it, you blew up your knee. Yeah. And so it just takes time. But you've sort of seen him get more and more comfortable with his teammates, and he's growing here. And he's to the point now that he's making a huge impact off the bench. Not so much on, you know, always with his scoring, but one of the things I mentioned, you know, I tweeted last night was, you know, despite that knee injury, it hasn't had any impact on his court vision. And that's the one thing he was always blessed with. He's a big point guard. He's a tall point guard, which is, you know, he always drew the Magic Johnson comparisons just because he has that same sort of height that he can see over his opponents. But he has such a great feel for his teammates and that court vision. And so that's the one thing that, you know, no matter how much damage, you know, his knee might have taken and how much of his athleticism might suffer for it, he hasn't lost that vision. And that's how he's really making his impact on this team. And it's such a great feel good story to see that guy, you know, coming back to the point that now it feels like he has a role. Now, granted, I don't know what the future holds.
And that's what I was going to ask you. Let's move on from Sean Livingston. But is it legit, or is it just a nice little sampling compared to what we were seeing before?
Yeah, and that man, I just don't know.
I mean, we're comparing him to Donald Sloan, right?
Yeah, and that's the thing is, you know, you wonder why the Cavs are playing better. Well, yeah, we've upgraded from Donald Sloan to Sean Livingston, and we've gone from, you know, Samardo Samuels I love Booby Gibson, but Wayne Ellington is playing much better basketball right now than Gibson was. And obviously, Maurice Spates is a pretty stark improvement over what we were getting out of Samardo Samuels. So, you know, that's sort of why the Cavs are playing better. So when you're going from a Donald Sloan to a, you know, Sean Livingston, you would certainly hope that you would see a much better performance. But I think the bigger question is Sean Livingston's home in Cleveland or not? Because, I mean, if you were to take what he's given them right now and you were to put him on, say, you know, the Oklahoma City Thunder, I don't know if they need that. You know, that's so, and it doesn't have to be the Thunder, but any good team, do they have as much of a use for Sean Livingston as a bad team does in the case of Cleveland? And then, of course, that begs the question, if the Cavaliers start to show some improvement going forward and they want to become an elite team, is Sean Livingston good enough to become, a part of that? I hope the answer is yes. I really do.
All right. Well, and you talked about Booby Gibson. What's his deal? He might be one of the most inexplicable players. I mean, not that it's a big deal, because I mean we're talking about. At one point, I think a lot of us thought he could be an actual legit starter, or at least a six or a seven, on a decent team. And how is
he? Yeah, they had him. He started the year after they went to the finals. I'm pretty sure they had him as a starter that following year. I don't know if Larry Hughes was hurt or what was going on with that, but I'm pretty sure that at the beginning of the year he was a starter on that team. So yeah, he's been a starter. the thing is he's always been sort of this big cherry on top. And what I mean by that is he was a late second round, or he was a, I shouldn't say late, but he was a second round pick. And you know, traditionally you don't expect much out of your second round picks. No. And so the fact that he was giving the Cavaliers anything at all was such a godsend, especially when their first round picks we're performing so miserably. And that's, you know, when the story is written on, you know, LeBron James' time in Cleveland, I think we all know one of the worst things that ever happened was drafting Luke Jackson. You know, that being such a failure as the only real first round pick that they paired with him, or, you know, top 10 first round pick, for him to be such a failure was just catastrophic to the team going forward. So for them to get anything out of Daniel Gibson was always just such a blessing. Let alone, though, for him to obviously have that huge game against the Pistons that sent the Cavs into the finals. And, you know, he's had a lot of huge games for the Cavaliers, and he's been an integral part of, you know, sort of different iterations of what they've been trying to do. Mike Brown, certainly had a role for him.
Mike Brown also frequently had him in the doghouse because he didn't think he could play defense.
And that's what I was just going to say, was the thing about the one thing I appreciate about Booby is that he's always been somebody to work on different aspects of his game. Now, as the Cavaliers are obviously a much worse defensive team now than they were under Mike Brown, but in recent years, Daniel Gibson has been one of our better backcourt defenders, that when we needed somebody who could sort of get in front of a opposing point guard and stop him from getting into the lane, you turn to Daniel Gibson.
Well, and his perimeter D was always undersold too.
Right. And he's always tried to work on things. You know, he tried to work for a while on a mid-range game. You know, one year he came in trying to attack the rim. I think at the end of the day, he just has a very limited skill set. He's a spot shooter. He needs to be set up. He needs to be left open in a spot and able to hit a shot. Now, that's not to say guys like that don't necessarily have some kind of a role in the NBA. But when the Cavaliers are trying to build a team, you just see with Wayne Ellington, as much as he was sold as just a spot up shooter, and that's still the best part of his game. He's able to sort of run the offense and initiate a little bit of offense himself. Well, he's a better ball handler.
But let's talk about Daniel Gibson a little bit differently. I mean, did it ever come out why he missed that game? I mean, is he wearing out his welcome? Is he becoming a bit of an attitude problem? Let's be nice and call it a culture mismatch?
Well, you got to realize that he came from these teams that, you know, he came from the 60-win Cavalier teams.
As fans, we've all had to adjust.
Right. But as a player, it's always different as a fan when all you can do is watch. When you're a player and you feel like you can make a difference on the court and you can actually affect the outcome of a game, you know, you probably view it a little bit differently. But I don't know why he missed that game. We were just told it was for personal reasons. I'm sure some people in the media might know what's going on with him. And I hate to speculate too much on it.
No. I don't want to speculate on the specifics either. I don't really care. I just wonder if it's symptomatic. I mean, we're talking about a longtime guy who's been in Cleveland a long time, and things have changed markedly around him. And we've seen it enough times in all sports that sometimes that change of scenery, a guy is just begging for it, and either consciously or subconsciously, it manifests itself in missing a lot of games. And it seems like Booby's been missing a ton of games.
Yeah, well, you know, he doesn't have a role anymore. He doesn't have minutes on this team. So it's not so much he has worn out his welcome as much as he's maybe trying to wear out his welcome. You certainly see what's happening with Omri Caspi, and the Cavaliers are working with him on a buyout for him. And, you know, supposedly you hear that the Rockets are interested. So suddenly
That's been one of the most weird, distracting, non-crucial player, like, leverage situations. I think I've heard Scott say it a couple times, and I don't think I'm blowing up the spot. I think he said it publicly, too. I mean, but who is this guy to be demanding anything?
Yeah, I don't know. I it's he's never going to be looked on fondly by Cavalier fans. Sacramento fans were not heartbroken to see him go. That trade just has to go down as one of the most worthless trades in NBA history. I mean, it's just funny to think about that, you know, JJ Hickson is long gone from Sacramento. And even as much as, you know, he's having a pretty good season on the court, he's still butting heads with sort of the coaches. You hear certain frustrations about him. I've read a lot about, you know, certain fan frustrations with parts of JJ's game. And from the Cavaliers' point of view, they got Omri Caspi, who just he's just been atrocious from day one. I mean, he's just never been able to give them any kind of, you know, consistent quality. And so, you know, once this goes through and he's gone from the team, you're gonna look at those. They swapped. Not only did they swap those two players and they're both gone, but they still have this stupid draft pick in limbo that, you know, I don't even know if the Cavaliers are ever gonna get that pick, other than, you know, whatever year it becomes, just a second round pick or whatever. So it's just such a weird trade.
Yeah. Well, and add in the fact that never ending fallacy that the Cavs refused to trade Hickson for Stoudemire.
Oh God.
That one just will not die. It will not die.
It's never going to, like, that. It's in the sort of public lexicon that it's to the point that nothing can refute it. I mean, when Brian Windhorst has repeatedly gone on record saying there's no merit to this, it's ridiculous. You know, when people don't listen to him, when it's able to, you know, get past, you know, his stamp of approval or and disapproval.
Dan Gilbert's addressed it too.
Yeah, like, nobody is saying, like, find me who is saying that this happened. Like, even Phoenix is not pushing it, saying that. Like, I don't know where this rumor comes from, but it's so ingrained in the lexicon. Like, you see it brought up almost every year.
Everybody just assumed that's what happened because Phoenix pulled out so randomly out of that trade and the talks, and it everybody was reporting that the talks mysteriously died, and so that was the natural assumption.
It's just so, I mean, I'm laughing just because if you just stop and think about it for a second, what you're trying to say is the Cavaliers said, no, we don't want Amari Stoudemire because we don't want to give up JJ Hickson. Like, there's just no way, like, there's no believability to it. It's so absurd, and maybe that's why it goes on, because maybe people assume it's so absurd that it has to be true, that nobody would even make up something like that.
Again, I'll do everything I can to avoid getting political, but we've seen since 9/11, the internet has been, like, it's devolved in certain corners of the internet into, like, instant conspiracy about everything. And it's not to say some conspiracies aren't worthwhile and aren't worthy pursuits, but it seems like no matter what happens now, there's a conspiracy theory to match up with it for something. And it's leaking into sports now too.
It's leaking into everything. I mean, there's no doubt that, you know, the internet and social media is changing our society. And I would probably argue that it's not for the better.
This is the argument I had with everybody when certain NBA guys were breaking draft picks 30 seconds before they happened. And it was like, well, what do you want me to do? Not do my job? Like, yes, that's exactly what you're not adding anything of value.
There's so much. It's all just instant gratification. That's the only thing that matters.
Well, don't follow me then. Well, I want to follow you. Shouldn't that be what you want?
Well, exactly. It's like, you know, you're a beat, or not a beat writer, but you're a NBA writer who has all the, or NFL, whatever the sport may be, but you have all these sources and you're constantly breaking, you know, stories. And obviously any fan of the sport wants to follow you. But then when it comes draft night, it's part of the fun is being a part of that communal spirit of being on Twitter.
When everybody wants you to break trades, they want you to break stuff like that, but don't tell us the pick 15 seconds before it happens.
Yeah, exactly. Like it's serving no purpose. Like nobody is out there saying, hey, follow whatever, you know, follow whoever the case may be. He's telling us who the draft picks are 15 seconds before they're actually made. Like, nobody wants that degree of...
That 15 seconds sooner doesn't help anybody.
Right, because, I mean, what are you going to do? Are you going to turn around and quickly call your friend and try and get a hold of him before that 15 seconds is up and say, hey, they're taking RG3, whatever. Like, no, I mean, I don't know. I just think that there's, in general, when I look at the way Twitter drives sort of the discourse in this, in this country, I think there's a lot of good things in terms of opening up discussions, and you get to talk to people that you would have never been able to talk to without it. People from all walks of life, different backgrounds, different beliefs, different values, and you get to bounce your ideas off of them. Like, that's all great, but the internet also just has this such a dark and seedy underbelly to it that drives, rumors and innuendo and this sort of, anonymous, keyboard nihilist, the guy who, is out to say whatever can be the most shocking thing you can say, and you can do it because you're anonymous, on the internet. Like, it's hard to find that balance between what's real value in the internet versus all this murkiness that surrounds
it. All right, so tell me something then. Do you get more annoyed with the person who's trying to shock everybody or the people who act like they're shocked every 5 minutes?
Well, I hate fake outrage way more than real outrage. Absolutely. Like, I get so fed up with people who try to turn every little thing into an incident. Like, and that it's not so much about just being politically correct. Like, I know people talk about the PC police or whatever, but it's something bigger than that. Like, there is this huge segment that it's like, because everybody thinks that they need to react to something that happens. So something happens and it's like, oh, I need to react to this on the internet.
Well, and I always bring it back to, like, Kobe Bryant when he screamed a gay slur and it got caught on camera. Like, I'm not saying that's okay, but I'm just saying, like, it's cool. They got it. Somebody was going to fine him. He was going to apologize. Like, it was a whole thing, but people still wanted to write 1,200 words on it. And it was like, there's no need for that outpouring or that outburst, because everybody has the same reaction, and the NBA is going to do something about it, and or his team's going to do something about it. This is just the natural course of the world. Somebody does something wrong, they get punished or they apologize, and then we move on. But it's like everybody wants to grandstand alongside of it as well.
Yeah, you're at a certain point, you're arguing against a wall. Like, who is against you? Like, Who is sticking up for gay slurs and saying no?
You're taking away his First Amendment rights. You always come against that person, but that's like, not legit.
It's so few and far between, anyways. Like, in general, yeah, like, everybody agrees with you. He shouldn't have said it. Like, who are you outraged against? And even Kobe, like you said, he apologized from it, and yeah. He's learned from it, and he had that. I just saw that just recently. I don't know if somebody used...
He criticized somebody else.
Yeah, somebody... Yeah, I can't remember who it was. Somebody used a gay slur or something, and maybe he criticized it, and somebody said, well, hey, who are you to say it because you used the slur yourself? And he's like, hey, idiot, like, yeah, I know, and I learned from it, and I grew up from it. And
I'm exactly the person who should be saying it.
Exactly. So, yeah, like, I don't know, like... It just seems like anytime anything happens, there's just such a rush to have a reaction to it and to get that out on the internet. And so you just get these instant reactions. And then, if somebody has a reaction that's different than yours, you have to be mad about it. And you And rather than just say, hey, I disagree and this is why, you have to say, oh my gosh, you are such an idiot. How can you think that? And like, I don't know, there's such this, I don't know, animosity on the internet with people. And like, you know, people have a hard time disagreeing with people cordially on the internet. And it's in such a different way than it is if you're talking to somebody face to face. And I know you've made points about that before. You know, it's certainly in our emails, our waiting for next year emails, talking sort of about how, you know, people are more prone to say, oh my gosh, you know, you're a bigot, or, you know, you're a racist, or you're a whatever, on the internet. But when you're talking to somebody in real life, you don't usually react that way. When somebody says it, you tend to be a little bit more measured in your response. And
right. And I remember this specific conversation, because my point in that conversation was that if somebody says something racist and your instant reaction is to call them a bigot and attack them with that, you're painting them into a corner where they're going to have to be defensive about it instead of giving them room to change and grow and become different or to you know, get better from it. If somebody drops a gay slur in front of you, you shouldn't get mad and call them a bigot, because they'll either shrink or they'll get defensive. You say, hey, look, I'm not sure why, you know, I'm not sure why you'd use that kind of language. I think you're better than that. Then you give them room to change. But if you don't give people room to change, they're just going to get worse. And I think we see a lot of that on the internet, where with this instant reactions and everybody wanting to react all the time, nobody gives anybody any room to kind of gain a new perspective or a new point of view.
Mm-hmm. And it's funny, because this kind of reminds me a little bit of, I don't know if you read this story.
We should be doing an after school special, I think.
Yeah, exactly. But I don't know if you read the art, or anything about this story. It was a couple weeks ago where a guy, slapped somebody else's child on an airplane. It was a white male. He slapped somebody else's child, who was, I don't know if they were crying or screaming or whatever. And the child, I think the child was African American, or, it was a minority of some sort. And the initial reaction fascinated me, because everybody was so quick. Like, I read a CNN article, and in the comments, everybody was so quick to say, oh my gosh, this guy is such a racist. And immediately his lawyer put out a statement saying, my client is not a racist. You guys don't know him. And like, all of a sudden this whole issue became about race. And I'm sitting here saying, well, he slapped somebody else's child on an airplane. Like, shouldn't the outrage be at that? Like, regardless, like, if it was a white child, people should be outraged at this. But by turning it into sort of a, you know, a race issue, I felt like they were almost giving him an out, because his lawyer was sitting there saying, oh, no, he's not a racist. But he slapped a child. Like, I feel like the narrative sort of got lost in that. And that was all because of that need to have that instant reaction of, oh my gosh, he must be a racist. Well, whether he is or isn't a racist, I mean, I don't know. I don't know the guy. And I mean, how could I ever say that? But he obviously has some kind of rage issues that caused him to slap somebody else's child. And maybe that's the issue here.
Well, and that's seriously the thing. I mean, I remember, before I had kids, you hear people talk about, you know, spanking and how a different generation would grab the switch and everything else.
Right.
I couldn't imagine spanking my kid. I just, at this point, you know, so yeah, for, let alone hauling off and slugging somebody else's kid on a plane. Oh man, I'm trying to think if even in my like wildest, biggest rage, if I could have done something like that. And I don't think so.
I don't.
But you're right. It's not the issue. They moved the issue.
But yeah, and I feel like it was almost in a way beneficial to him for people to start calling him a racist, because in the comments section, then you have people starting to defend him and saying, "Hey, now you know, just because he slapped this child doesn't mean he's a racist, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Oh, no. And if we're going to start getting into, like, the comment section on CNN, I mean, you want to talk about the most predictable thing in the world. CNN, certainly YouTube. YouTube comments are the most predictable things in the world, and they're also the worst things
in
the world.
No. The worst is any technology site, because no matter whether they're covering a Droid or an iPhone article, or, you know, PC versus Mac. Like, those arguments drive me nuts more than anything. Like, especially the Droid versus iPhone thing. Like, I think that is the most asinine thing that people argue about. Like, it's a phone. They both more or less do the same thing. They both more or less have the same apps. Like,
well, and it finally got to that. It got to that point in video games, because people used to argue about, you know, Xbox versus PlayStation, and then at some point, like, our generation got to their 30s, and we're still playing video games, and it was like, oh yeah, we're adults. We could just buy both now if we really want them.
Exactly.
You know, but the choosing is left for high school kids who are kind of subject to, you know, their parents still and whatever else. And no parent would allow you to have both systems, you know, when we were in high school. But I was going to draw a parallel here, because I think the closest thing we had to those kinds of wars, and it was the most miserable time I think I've ever had writing Cleveland sports, certainly at waiting for next year, and that was Mangini.
Oh, in terms of the pro and con, whether you were polarizing for him or against him? Yeah, I mean, it absolutely was polarizing. And again, I just always had to kind of sit back and, I don't know if laugh is the right word, because it wasn't necessarily funny, but I was like, we are arguing this hard or this fiercely about a guy who won 5 games in back-to-back years. Like, not that in and of itself tells the whole story, but it was like, there's so much. Like, we as Cleveland sports fans, we just get so worked up and angry sometimes over the smallest things, because it's like we've just gone crazy. We really have. Like, Cleveland sports fans have gone crazy.
No, but it's like, you know, all the nitpicking you do, like, or I'll nitpick with my wife, and we'll be kind of bickering and fighting about something. And really, the problem is that it's, like, been raining for 5 straight days. Mm-hmm. And so Browns fans were, it'd been raining for over a decade for Cleveland Browns fans. And so they were just beating on each other over Eric Mangini because everything sucked. It really didn't have much to do with Eric Mangini. It was just that everything sucked. So, you know, there were those.
That's what I loved. Your podcast with Scott Rabb was just awesome. And I loved, you know, when he made the point, we as Cleveland sports fans, we don't even have standards anymore. Like, to say our standards are low doesn't do it justice. Like, we don't have standards. Like, the things that we will, you know, sort of hang our hats on and proclaim moral victories, it is definitely awfully skewed compared to what almost any other sports city would sort of view it.
Well, let's talk about that in relation to the Cavs then. I have this sneaking suspicion that the Cavaliers, somewhere down the road, in hindsight, if we watch the Cavs wait till 2014, even not even LeBron, but any of those other free agents, I think this offseason is the one where they take their draft pick and they should sign if they could, this would be the offseason to sign the really great player and lock him up long term. Not wait one more year where you're dealing with Kyrie's contract as well as, you know, potentially free agents.
Well, and this is what's – I've been emailing with Jacob. Jacob had mentioned – I don't know which – one of my articles that I had written, Jacob put a comment in there, and he talked about, you know, the Oklahoma City Thunder in their 2008-2009 season. This was Durant's second year, Russell Westbrook's first year, and this was before they even drafted James Harden. And they started out that year 3-29. And they were just abysmal. But they ended up going I think they went something like 20 and 30 over their last 50. They just really played better basketball. And so we've been sort of going back and forth on putting together kind of an article about that. But in my last email to Jacob, I said, I really feel like we're sort of standing on the precipice here. Like this rebuild is going to go one of two ways, and we're teetering on that, the apex of that right now. Like these next 4 months are just going to be monumental in where we go from here, because we're going to find out a little bit more about, can Deion Waiters keep this up for the rest of the year? Like this, the way he's been playing in 2013 compared to, you know, 2012 is just night and day. I mean, he got sent to the bench for the first game of 2013. You know, he's since returned to the starting lineup, but rather than sulk or, you know, get mad at the coach or anything like that, like he took it as a personal challenge and he changed his game. He's attacking the rim more. He's being a lot more selective with his shot. And the other thing that I can't explain is not only is he going at the rim more, but he's finishing at the rim. He's actually making a lot more of his layup attempts as well. So we're going to find out, is this the real deal? You know, going forward for the rest of the year, is this the real Deion Waiters, or was what we saw in 2012 the real Deion Waiters? So we're going to find that out. The Cavs are also going to get another high first round draft pick in this draft. And they also are set up to do whatever they want to do in this offseason. And I think that's where your point sort of comes into play.
Right, and that was my question. Do you think they should go after it right now, this offseason?
What I think they should really strongly consider doing is maybe look – I don't know if that they're ready to be a player in the free agent market. I just don't know if an impact free agent is really ready to come sign with Cleveland yet. What I would consider doing if I was them is really think about making a big trade. Whether that, you know, I've long been on the let's keep Andy Varejao train, like, and I still mostly would like to keep him. But I would start maybe floating him out there a little bit. Float around the first round draft pick and see what you can get for that. Because one of the things I mentioned to Jacob, I said, what was so fascinating about that Thunders in the ways that they are, that 2008-2009 season, they're so similar to the Cavaliers in the way they both teams started out really poorly, and then that sort of the light bulb went off for them, and they started playing better later in the year. And that part of that was their rookies playing better. Russell Westbrook was, you know, not all that effective at the beginning part of his rookie season, and he started to sort of get it towards the end. And that's happening with Deion Waiters. But the other thing that the Thunder did was they made a couple big trades, not unlike how the Cavs are making trades this year. But they also traded.
Is that when they brought in Perk?
No, not yet. They hadn't done that. But what they did do was they traded their first-round pick to the Bulls, and that first-round pick was Taj Gibson. They sent him to the Bulls for Cephalosha. And Cephalosha was a – you know, say what you will about him, but he was a huge impact on that team in changing their defensive identity. And I think that that's something the Cavaliers really need to consider going into this offseason, is they need to find – maybe more so than just Anderson Varejao, who is a great defensive player, but I'd really like to see a versatile defender who can sort of defend the anywhere from the one to the three position and just be a lockdown defender, and somebody who can sort of change that defensive mentality, and where it just infects the whole team, and they start to give a little bit better defensive effort. Because I've heard you mention it in previous podcasts, and I couldn't agree with you more that so much of defense is effort. And, you know, when I watch, you know, as much as I love Kyrie Irving, we watch him play defense. I mean, so many times the opposing point guard is by him, and it just doesn't look like he's even trying to slow him down. Like, he is just content.
Well, and I don't disagree with you. I think they could use a role player on that defensive side, but I think it's time one way or another. And I think you're right where the Cavs should consider trading the draft pick, because I think it's time to go get that other guy who could go off for 30 plus points on any given night, because that would give the Cavs in this season, this upcoming season, that would give them three players, assuming Deion Waiters is still, you know, developing. I mean, I think he's pretty well proven that he's good for 20 to 25 on a decent night. If he continues to get a little bit better, he'll be a threat for 30 on any given night. Kyrie's a threat for 30 on any given night, and they need to bring in an established guy. Not saying Danny Granger, but think that style of scorer or even Michael Redd before he got old, who was just a constant threat to be 30. Not necessarily the load carrier or the superstar, but the precipice all-star who is capable of going off for 30.
Like if you were to take out his contract, Rudy Gay would have been the perfect guy. I think he would have been a great asset to this team. But obviously, with his contract, he didn't make any sense for the Cavaliers, and there was no way they were going to, you know, even consider making a run for him. But you're right. Like, that's the kind of guy that it would be awesome if they could find. I just don't know if that guy's out there yet. Like, that's sort of the problem. That's where Chris Grant, you know, sort of has to go to work and put the glasses on. And
it'd be nice if he could find the next Ginobili.
Yeah, like
young Ginobili.
Yeah, there just has to be. You're right. Like, as much as we like seeing Tristan Thompson's development, you know, he's obviously a grit guy. Like, he's the guy you want the double doubles out of, but he's not going to give you, you know, 20 points a night. Like, that's just never going to happen. And so if you just had that one other guy who was just a threat to score, is that an asset in and of itself, but it also makes things a lot easier for Kyrie and Deion as well. And that's where we're going to see whether, you know, Deion Waiters' ceiling is one of the most intriguing things, because he has, you can just see his effort, his heart that he plays with. He's a fearless basketball player, and I love that kind of a basketball player. But he also makes some decisions that I understand why other people are skeptical of him, and so his ceiling is so variable. Like, I just don't know what Deion Waiters is. Like,
well,
what
the one thing that I think that we see, because we watch him night in and night out, is that his ceiling, yeah, it's variable at this point, but I think a lot of the stuff that people are most critical about him are tied to youth and immaturity. I mean, he plays almost angry at times, and with that edge, you know, you could just see the Philly coming out of him, and that's not a bad thing, but it's something that guys tend to learn how to control. You know, it works pretty well in the college game and the March Madness environment, where, you know, I don't know. It's like over 82 games. I mean, it'll cause you more problems than it'll help you. And I think that's something that you expect a guy to get in year two or year three. And he's just young, man.
That's the thing. And that's my biggest issue that I have with some of the harsh criticism, and I don't want to pick on, you know, Matt Moore, on this, from, you know, CBS Sports, who has a lot of, you know, maybe sort of harsh things to say about Deion on his Twitter account. But I think my biggest problem that I have with his criticism of Deion is that he seems to be criticizing him as if he was a fifth year player. And, you know, he likes to harp on his shot selection, you know, oh, he just takes terrible shots, nothing but contested jumpers. Well, I would argue with that not only is that not even all that true anymore. Like, yes, he does still take some contested jumpers for sure. But he's a shooting guard. Like, that's part of the position. Like, all of the great shooting guards are going to take some contested jumpers. Like, that's what you're being paid to do. But beyond that, Deion has gotten much better at being aggressive and attacking the rim. And he's a rookie. He's what is he? 20 years old.
you know, how many guys at the Cavaliers can even legally drink? Like, these guys are, this team is, especially the starters, are just so young. And people sometimes criticize them as if you can say, well, this is their track history. They are who they are. And that's just not the case. And I hate to keep harping on this because I say it all the time, but, you know, shooting guards, it's the hardest position to adjust from college to NBA. It takes them the most time in general to get it. And so for Deion to be showing the steps that he's already shown, like, he is leaps and bounds ahead of where I ever imagined he was going to be this year, especially after what we saw out of him in Summer League. Like, when he came out in Summer League out of shape, and I mean, he just looked atrocious, and I was legitimately scared, you know, that maybe the Cavs had made a mistake. But he's just shown in just one season, his rookie year, how much he can improve. And so, yeah, like, by year two, by year three, as he learns more and more and gets more and more comfortable, his ceiling could get really high. But at the same time, sure, maybe he will fall on his bad habits, and maybe he will fall back into taking a lot of contested jumpers. I don't know.
Maybe he'll become DeJuan Wagner.
Yeah, I mean, it could. That's certainly possible. Anything is possible with Deion Waiters at this point. But to your point, you know, sort of bringing this back around, if the Cavaliers actually were to find a third consistent scoring option, I just think it would make things so much easier for Kyrie and Deion. And I think it's more important that things are easier for Deion, because then he'll continue to be aggressive, and he'll only get better and better. And I just think that – I mean, I just saw on Chris Sheridan's website, they do their rookie rankings, and Deion's up to number three in their rookie rankings now. And I just think that's such a testament to the hard work he's put in improving and getting better and taking everything to heart. Like, you know, so many people sometimes misunderstand arrogance with defiance, I think. I think that sometimes people assume that Deion has a bad attitude because of his confidence. But I think that
his he plays with that scowl.
Yeah.
That nastiness.
The Ray Allen snarl. You know, Ray Allen always played with that snarl, and Deion has that for sure.
Yeah, and that's, and I think a lot of people mistake that for something else. And I think over time we've seen that his teammates and his coach don't really react negatively to it. And in general, he seems to respond to different forms of motivation. And to Matt Moore's defense, I mean, he watches tons of basketball. He watches tons of different teams. But unless you're obsessing on every minute of every Cavs game, you're not going to notice the subtleties that, like, we notice. And sometimes I think we lose patience that not everybody can catch up with, that, you know,
yeah,
watching every minute of every game like we do.
Sure. And we're all guilty of confirmation bias, too.
Sure.
On both sides of it. You know, I saw where yesterday, and again, I'm not trying to pick on Matt, because I really like Matt a lot, but he had tweeted a video. He said, "This is the problem of Deion Waiters." And all it was one play of him taking a contested jumper. It was like an 18-second video of one play from that game of him taking a contested jumper and missing it. And I was like, that is such an extreme example of confirmation bias, where, you know, you're isolating the things that confirm your beliefs already and discounting any other evidence. Now, we're more prone to see the good things that Deion does and discount, you know, those contested jumpers. We will write those off as, oh, that was just, you know, oh, that was just a bad decision. But, you know, but look at all the times he attacked the rim. So we're just as guilty of it, too.
And nobody knows better than we do, because how many years do we defend those, like, heat check, ridiculous three-pointers that LeBron used to take?
Yeah, yeah. And that's what I've always told my friends and, you know, other people. I've always said the best part about LeBron not being on the Cavaliers is not having to defend the things that I struggled to defend.
Cough, crab dribble.
Yeah, exactly. Like, or even the, you know, the Jordan Crawford issue with the getting dunked on and,
yeah,
you know, removing the tape, like all that stuff. Like, yeah, like it's just, you know, you defend your guys, and And this sort of, maybe this, we're kind of going full circle here again, but this kind of, I think it's kind of an interesting point, going back to talking about why people, you know, defend their iPhone so, you know, so viciously. I saw a thing with the president of Gearbox Software. They're a video game developer. He gave a speech and he talked about a social experiment that took place where they laid out a whole bunch of different items, and basically, like, they told people to rank all the different items, and then they gave them a choice to pick between two of the items. Like, they picked up two of the items and said, "Here, choose one or the other." And without doubt, the person chose the item that they had previously already ranked higher. But what was fascinating was then what they did was, I forget exactly where the bait and switch was, but somehow they did something where it made them rank everything again. And without fail, they inherently always ranked the item that they had chosen higher the second time than they did the first time. And that's what it all comes down to, validating our choices. And we validate the teams we root for. And so that's where we're more prone to be accepting of some of Dion's faults, maybe. And we look for the positives because we're trying to validate that choice. Whereas, you know, on Matt Moore's case, and there's many others besides Matt, like anybody who sort of laughed at the Cavs for taking Deion Waiters fourth because it was a little bit of a surprise pick. So they all sort of panned the pick and looked at it from a negative point of view.
No, and it happens within the fan base, because, like, when the Browns took John Hughes and we felt like the team was a laughing stock, you know, we quickly went from, oh my God, I can't believe this is what they're doing with their draft, and this is the biggest waste of a pick since Gerard Warren and blah, 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 blah. And then 2 weeks later, it's all, well, maybe he'll work out, you know, maybe Tom Heckert knows more than we do. And then, you know, that turns into full blown, he's filling in off the bench as a rookie. You know?
Yeah, the fragile psyche of the sports fan.
Yeah. Well, and that's a good place to stop. It's getting late here on the East Coast. It is 11:33 p.m., and I have a long day ahead of me, so.
Yeah. Well, have fun. Have fun representing the site.
You and I are the only ones who can have absolutely nothing to talk about, and all of a sudden, an hour and 1 minute later.
That's crazy.
I am now in a position to say this has been the Waiting for Next Year.com podcast.